happens to someone's estate if they die without a will? What about families who've lost touch and might not even realise that a relation has died? Now, this is where a group of genealogical researchers called Heir Hunters come in. And in the wake of the pandemic, I'm told they're busier than ever. Danny Curran is the founder of Finders International. They specialise in tracking down relatives. Hi, Danny. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. How do you get involved? Who hires you?
Well, the cases come from a wide variety of sources. We can be contacted by anyone from the hospital, the local authority, through to a solicitor who's got a problem trying to trace someone that needs to be found who's due to inherit. So it's a wide range of referrals.
Okay. What are your resources? How do you find people? How do you track people down?
Okay. So I've been doing this kind of work for about 30 years, and it's come to people's attention more in the last. There were 12 series of Heir Hunters, which we were the main firm on, and people got to know us through that. So we've actually sort of come to a point where we're fairly well known. The resources we use are usually public resources, but we have to be licensed for a lot of the things. But some things, we started with basic family tree work, which many people have done, using things like Ancestry Online to work out who's related to who, and then following the laws of intestate succession, work out who is entitled. And then once we have a name of a person, because we're obviously starting usually from a name of a person who's died and nothing else, then we worked out who's entitled, who it could be, the name of that person, then we go on to trace them and maybe visit them in person or contact them by phone or letter normally.
What are the rules about who inherits where there is no will? What sort of family tree branches do you go down first to try and find somebody according to the inheritance laws?
Yeah, so there's a set laws for England and Wales, and actually one of the things I'd like us to do is change the Scottish system, because it's much more generous, and it would deprive the Crown of about £20 to £30 million a year, which would go to ordinary people instead. The reason for that is that we cut off our inheritance at the point of living descendants of whole or half-blood uncles and aunts. And as you imagine, as time goes on, families get smaller and smaller, and there is the order of succession is spouse issue, parents, siblings. Then you go to half-blood siblings, then descendants of your paternal and maternal grandparents, so your uncles and aunts, basically, on both sides. If they've all died, then it goes to the cousins. If they've all died, it goes to first cousins once removed, and so on and so on. So although a lot of cases do have living next of kin eventually, there's still a large number that are dying out. And we're still kind of in the age where a person who's dying now may be born in the 1920s or 1930s. The chances are their parents were having part of big families. You know, they're still part of large families, where there's a large number of descendants. But as time goes on, you know, in my generation, my parents, my mum's one of two and my dad's one of four.
I don't know whether it's a socioeconomic thing. My dad grew up in a very poor family, but I'm still in a family where there are eight uncles and aunts. I have eight uncles and aunts. My dad was one of nine. So, yeah. But I see what your point, though, because our family's one of two. We've only had two children. It narrows down as you go down the generations, doesn't it?
Yeah, and in Scotland what they do is they allow descendants of great-uncles and aunts to be included. So the pool becomes indefinite, really. You then have a huge, much bigger pool of potential beneficiaries. But, yeah, in most cases, you know, 80-odd percent, there'll be someone there eventually. And very often it's a complete surprise to them. They've never heard of the person.
Do they, when you turn up on the doorstep, it must be like a bit of a Jeremy Beadle moment. Do they always take you seriously straight away? Do they think that people are so mistrustful these days? I learned that at the beginning of the pandemic when I put notes through neighbours' doors offering to do their shopping, and someone called the police on me thinking I was trying to scam them.
Well, there you go. I mean, and your last caller I was listening to saying that he doesn't trust many people. And, you know, and this is obviously a common issue, and we, in order to try and get around that, we just join as many bodies. We set up an independent business regulatory regime internationally called the International Association of Professional Probate Researchers. There's no other international body that regulates genealogists, and with firms abroad, we've tried to introduce a conduct code and ways of working so that we introduce an element of regulation to the industry.
Right.
So That's internal in the industry. Externally, there are trading standards initiatives which hopefully people have heard of, but probably haven't. There's a thing called Friends Against Scams, where you're trained and guided on producing material, you know, letters, emails that look less scammy and are less suspicious in the way that they look.
Yeah.
If these initiatives get known more widely and people know that they can check us on the... We're in the borough of Hackney, London Borough of Hackney. Mm. And if they can go onto Hackney's website and see that we're a genuine firm because we're endorsed, you know, we have a trading standards partnership, it's called, with Hackney, which means that they know who we are, they checked us out. So there are things online, but you're quite right. I mean, the average, the amount of times we hear that people, our first letter's gone in the bin, or someone's called, we do get calls from the police as well, saying, what's all this about? You've been knocking on this person's door.
Yeah.
So you're not alone in having the police
called
on you.
Yeah. Final quick thought about the emotional side of all of this, because these are stories of people who've died without contact with their family. Have you become inured to it, or do you still see the sad side of all of that?
What I see is that there's, as you've said exactly there, many people think this is a sad situation, but I've been to see families and I've heard amazing stories of people having incredible lives, you know, travelling the world. I've seen family photos of the lives they had, and just because they didn't know their family doesn't mean that they had a sad life. Yes, there are some people who are isolated and hoarders and become very, very introspective and don't speak to anyone for years. There are those situations. Social isolation is a big issue. But we have many cases where people have these fantastic lives but just not bothered to make a will and you know, gone out with a bang, you know. And it's actually quite... it's bittersweet is the thing for relatives, because... We'll talk to them and they think, oh, you know, it's lovely that I know about them now, and but I would have liked to have met them. Mm. So it's kind of, they've got a memory, they've got a family tree, they've got a connection, maybe some money as well. But it doesn't mean that people are jumping up and down or sobbing necessarily. It just means that everyone is different and they view it in a different way. And very often I'm able to tell people about what a lovely life this person had.
Mm. That's a nice thing to be able to do then. I take that on board. It's really nice to talk to you, Danny. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
It's a pleasure.
Danny Curran, talking to you from Finders International. We're going to have more on this in the next half hour of the show. This is BBC Radio Kent. It's now 11:31. We were hearing a little bit about the work of Finders International, who you might have seen on Air Hunters on TV. And we were looking at when somebody dies with some sort of property or money or something to leave, but they haven't got a will, and why that happens and how it can be that people in a family don't know about these relatives and their lives and their deaths. So let's get a little bit more on this. Let's find out a little bit more about how this plays out in people's lives. Dave Lockwood also works for Finders International, but he used to work in Kent as what's called a deputy, helping those who don't appear to have close family, both before they've died and then dealing with things in the immediate aftermath. David, it's really nice to have you with us. How are you?
Good morning, Julia. Yeah, fine, thank you. Apart from a rotten cold at the moment, but all good.
I feel so sorry for people with colds at the moment. One of my colleagues came in, he said, I've been working from home the last couple of days. I've got a rotten cold and I just, you know, very clearly got a cold. It's really tough, isn't it? Because everyone looks at you at the moment. Like, if it had been this time last year, people would have thought, oh, poor Robert, poor David, he's got a cold. And yeah, now they don't want to come anywhere near you. Never mind, doesn't matter on the radio, as long as you feel well enough to talk to us.
I'm well enough, thank you.
Good stuff. Tell me a bit more. I sort of gave a brief description there, but you can do a much better job. What is a deputy, the work that you used to do here in Kent?
A deputy is somebody that looks after somebody's finances or health and welfare under the court protection. So, for instance, if somebody loses capacity to manage their finances, doesn't have a lasting power of attorney in place, then somebody needs to act for them, wanting to care. I used to work for in Kent as a deputy, and we used to manage people's finances as a last resort because nobody else was there to manage them.
It makes me feel really sad just thinking about that situation. Is it sad? Is it always sad when you end up finding someone and thinking they haven't got anyone?
Yeah, it is sad. You have a responsibility for that person. I mean, under the Mental Capacity Act, you have to act in their best interests anyway. Yes. So there is that set in law that you have to do that. But, you know, as a deputy, you'd want to act for that person as if they were a member of your own family, somebody that you loved. You know, you're looking after their things. You're looking after their property. You're looking after their life, basically. And it's in your hands.
What are the sorts of things that those people do need help with as perhaps they're starting to lose capacity in some way?
You're looking at people, say, for instance, that have gone into care and don't have anybody to, you know, look after their daily needs. For instance, we had a chap that was a football referee and his house was full of his football mementos, trophies, things like that. And he was in this care home in a very small room, and nobody really knew anything about him. So what we were able to do was to take all his football mementos to him, to his room. And obviously that helped him. Obviously with dementia, it stirred memories and things like that and helped him relate to people. And people could then relate to him and talk about football to him and everything like that. So those are the kind of things that we did. We tried to enable people to live their lives if they possibly could.
I love the idea about capturing something of who they have been. I mean, we wear lots of different hats throughout our lives, don't we? But to be able to bring somebody something that reminds them who they once were, who they have been, what mattered to them, it must be really moving on those occasions.
It can be. It can be very moving. I'm a dementia friend. I'm a dementia friend champion. So I champion dementia friends for Alzheimer's, and I do that through working for Finders as well. But one of the things that I understand through that is that you know, the memories are still there. So if you can stimulate somebody's life and interact with them, just give them some form of give them a decent standard of life. You know, when there is nobody else, you know. Yeah. So we're responsible. We were responsible for these people to make sure that they were looked after as in their best interest, but also that they had a decent standard of life. And that was the principle that I used, and certainly the people I work with used as well.
Did you end up acting in some ways as a sort of family counsellor, or is it so absolute that there is no family in this situation that you really are only dealing with the individual?
You're only dealing with the individual normally. There are times when family we do manage to trace family, and they're not irate, but they're angry that they've not been tracked down beforehand. We don't know why, you know, they've gone into care of this person. We don't know about people's histories. I mean, families are a strange beast. Every single family is different. And their lives the way they want to live. Somebody, for instance, wants nothing to do with them and lives away, has no contact with anybody. It's their choice. They've done that. But obviously gone into, you know, into a situation where they've lost capacity, and their family comes along and they're not angry about it, but there is that sense of you've got to talk to them about what's gone on, get them involved and they're there.
Just a final quick question. We are slightly losing the quality of the phone line for some reason. I hate it when that happens. Nobody's fault. How much do you draw on your experience as a deputy in the work you now do? Because you're with Finders International now, aren't you?
I am. The work I do for Finders, I've had to do a few. It's funny you were saying to Danny a while ago about door knocks. I've had to do a few of those where you've gone and knocked on somebody's door and you have to explain to them what's gone on. And, you know, they do give you that look of, well, who are you? What are you here for? This is so understanding how people fit into the relationships and trying to explain to them the person that's passed away and where they sit with things. So, there are lots of skill sets there. And I'm, you know, I still do a lot of work for local authorities and for deputies that work across the country. We run events for them and things like that with Finders. So it's nice to be able to give something back to them as well. But, yeah, I use my experience I've built up over the 30-odd years I was working in receivership and then deputyship. So it's nice being able to give something back.
Great to talk to you, David. Thank you. David Lockwood, who was a really interesting work as a deputy and all connected and now works for Finders International. So part of what we're talking about here is what happens if someone dies without a will, because we, and I do apologise to her and to you, had lost our solicitor, Alexandra Gordon, in the midst of our technology here at BBC Radio Kent. She's a partner at Brasher's in Maidstone and vice president of the Kent Law Society. And I'm so sorry to have lost you in that. It's a terrible place to get lost, BBC technology. And we're glad we've got you back, Alexandra. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
No, it's a pleasure. We've been talking a lot in this hour of the programme about what it means to the surviving family who may not even know when someone has died and has died without a will. Talk me through your understanding of this. What are some of the reasons that people don't make a will? How do people who are still alive justify that?
Quite a few people are actually worried if they put a will in place that something's going to happen to them. Mm. So that's one of the main...
What a kind of don't tempt fate. If I make a will, it's tempting fate that something's going to happen
exactly.
to me.
Mm. Exactly.
That's what psychologists would call magic thinking, isn't it?
Yep. and then other reasons are that the cost, the time it takes maybe to put it in place, it's just something that's put on the back burner.
Mm. Yeah, I can understand that one. I mean, gosh, we've all got lists of, you know, to-do lists, haven't we? This is a big to-do thing and it's important. But you can see how that happens in people's lives.
Definitely. But when we see clients after the process, they do realise what a quick and easy process it is. And also as well, they get a lot more advice than just their wills. So normally you're advising on inheritance tax and estate planning as well. Okay. So they get a lot out of it.
Yeah. And when people say things like estate planning, I always think it's a curious phrase, isn't it? Because it makes you think of grand country estates. And then suddenly maybe people think, oh, that's not me. I don't have an estate. But to an extent, we all have an estate, even if we don't own a home. We have things, don't we, that are going to have to, that something's going to happen to our stuff when we go.
Correct. And it's just making sure that your assets pass to those people in the correct way, whether that's absolutely, or through using a trust structure.
Hmm. What do you suggest to people about who they discuss things with when they make a will? I mean, I'm presuming some people are very private and they only want to talk to a solicitor or somebody else who's in a position to help them. Do some other people talk more widely in their family, discuss their plans? What's good practice?
I think with quite a few people, it's other professionals who maybe push them towards making a will. So if they're buying a house, they're getting a mortgage, their accountant, they tend to see these people at a time of change in their lives, and they tend to push people towards seeing a solicitor to do their wills.
Tell me about the common misconceptions about what will happen. I mean, what do people think will happen if they don't make a will? Do they think, oh, it doesn't matter because it will all just go to X, Y or Z?
Correct. I think the main one is for unmarried couples. Or couples not in civil partnerships, under the intestacy provisions, they get absolutely nothing. So that's a very common misconception. And same with married couples, you would assume that under the intestacy provisions, your surviving spouse would receive everything, when actually they don't. There is a limit on it.
Okay. And what about, one of the things that I think is awful is when somebody dies, even with a will sometimes, but certainly without a will, would be the family tensions, the hackles, the issues that could be raised afterwards. You could save a lot of anguish, couldn't you, for the surviving relatives?
Definitely, because you're making sure your wishes are known to your whole family, so everyone's got clarity as to what you wanted. So it can help with any disagreements that come later. Mm.
Lots of people worried about mixing at the moment. Can you do a will without actually in person going into a solicitor's office?
Yes, so we are seeing virtually clients to take will instructions, and then we can either send the wills out for signature with instructions, or we have got socially distanced big meeting rooms with screens up, masks, etc. Everyone with separate pens, but they can come in and sign. There is new legislation just being passed which allows you to sign wills virtually, but it's quite complicated, I think, to make sure people follow all the steps. So
okay, so if you can do it in, yeah, there are other options. It's important, isn't it, at the moment, to look at everything that we do and how it can be done differently. And I'm sure in your industry that's been the case, as it has in all the others. Nice to talk to you today, Alexandra. Sorry to keep you waiting while we found you in the technology. Solicitor Alexandra Gordon, just a few thoughts there on why people don't make wills, that whole kind of magic thinking, tempting fate thing, and what the consequences are. And it seems that you can do them now in a COVID secure way.